You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I'm excited for you to listen to this podcast. It's with Jia Zhang, who is the owner of Rejection Therapy, a website that provides inspiration, knowledge, and products for people to overcome their fear of rejection. He is also the CEO of Wuju Learning, a company that teaches people and trains organizations to become fearless through rejection training. In 2015, he authored a best-selling book, Rejection Proof, How I Beat Fear and Became Invincible Through 100 Days of Rejection. We'll talk a little bit about that. And he has a new book, and this is what the bulk of the interview is going to be about. This book is called Easy Discipline, An Unconventional Way to Achieve Ambitious Things. Enjoy the pod. Jia Zhang, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Kelly, thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Me too. So the introduction of your new book, you offer a new interpretation of the myth of Sisyphus.
Yes.
This is the cursed figure in Greek myth who is eternally pushing a rock uphill. This myth is normally a cautionary tale, but you offer a different perspective, which is highly unusual. So tell us how you picture that myth.
Yeah, speaking of picture, if you're watching this video, I put this on my t-shirt. So this is the new version of Sisyphus.
There you
go. So what happens is when I first learned the Sisyphus story, I thought there's one question that came to my mind, right? So this guy pushing the rock eternally but can never get to the top. Every time the rock gets to the top, the rock will roll back to the bottom. And the only question that came to my mind is, what's the mental state of Sisyphus? Is he like alive or dead, right? If he's alive, so if he's mind controlled, right, he becomes like some sort of insight, like maybe some sort of insect with a parasite, right? He has no free will. So he's already dead. But if he's alive, that means he has free agency. That means he chose to go back down to the bottom and push rock again. And at least I chose to believe in this story. And why is that? So if the curse is on the rock itself, not on Sisyphus, then why did he make that decision? There must be only one conclusion. He likes pushing rocks. You know, and if he likes pushing rocks, then this is no longer a curse because Zeus just built him an eternal peloton, you know, something that is he can forever do something he loves. So this is my new interpretation, but also it's my interpretation of the world. If we hate what we're doing, then what we do will be like the old version of Sisyphus in the traditional interpretation, which is push the rock we hate and every day is the same. But what if we love doing it? Then that's be amazing. Then Sisyphus will become the best rock pusher in history. You know, he's the happiest person in the world. He never ends his happiness. So I choose to believe in that version of Sisyphus.
So you in many ways are sort of the king of a reframe. So this is something I wish I had known earlier in my career, but I learned it along the way, and that it's a superpower. The idea to sort of reframe a situation you're in to work to your advantage. And I guess this starts with the thing that you're best known for, because when I told people I was interviewing you and they might not know your name, and I go, he's the rejection guy. Do you remember the guy who like tried to ask a cop if he could drive his car? And they're all like, yeah. So tell our audience, for those few people who maybe don't know this part of you, which turned into a book, is what that was in terms of you leaning into rejection.
So when when I was running my startup, I wanted to get my company funded. I got rejected. I felt terrible. And the first thought that came to my mind is, I'm not good enough. You know, this other person, he knew so much more about business than I did. If he didn't find my company, that means my idea sucked. You know, that means maybe I wasn't up to the, you know, he didn't choose me. I wasn't up to it. You know, I wasn't up for it. So then I thought, oh man, I can't think this way. I can't just quit like that. No one was successful at anything can think like that. So I'd be like, I'm really afraid of rejection, as it turned out. So I did a reframe. Instead of running away from rejection, what if I look for rejection? You know, I found this thing called rejection therapy. I later on actually bought the website and bought all the game and stuff. It's a game that invented by this Canadian entrepreneur. And so basically, it asks you to look for rejection, you know, instead of running away from it. So I started doing this project called 100 Days of Rejection Therapy. My goal was to look for rejection once per day for 100 days. And I want to have fun with rejection. I want to make this like the most enjoyable thing ever. So that's what I did. And it completely blew up, you know, and it became like a viral sensation, got millions and millions of views and, you know, people. And that was more than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Ever since, people, this thing, rejection therapy has like become pretty, I wouldn't say mainstream, but it developed some sort of a cult-like following online. A lot of younger people start doing this on TikTok. You know, so I started this on YouTube. Now it has a second live on TikTok. Many of them, you know, said they learned this through me, you know, watched me doing this long time ago. And some of them don't even know who I am because they started from other people. It's crazy. You start a movement, you know, I started a movement in one platform, you went to another platform. So a lot of people are doing that nowadays.
This is what's so interesting about us having this conversation, because we've spoken before. We have a mutual friend, Zoe Chance, who introduced us years ago. And I wrote Yes And 10 years ago, so right around the time you were doing this. I didn't invent Yes And, but I am known as the Yes And guy. It took off in its own way. And then I think both of us did something kind of interesting, which was like we did this thing. Got some traction, and then we got curious about, well, what's sort of deeper, and what are other stories you can tell that are beneath these sort of framing ideas? And the way you open your book is so interesting to me, because I'm not the hugest hockey fan. I am a sports fan, and certainly the story that any American who is looking at, you know, the Olympics and any sort of recent, the miracle on ice is like the biggest thing. When the U.S. beat the Russians, and then went on to win the gold medal. And, you know, it was a movie, there was a book, there was articles, there was all that stuff. And rather than dig into the American story, which is, you know, why would you? Everyone's been told that story. You actually dig into the Russian story. So first off, I just assumed like the Russians were always on top, but that wasn't the case. They were not, and it was the Canadians that they had to learn to beat. So tell us a bit of that origin story that starts the book.
Yeah, so after World War II, Russia started developing their national hockey program. They had no history in hockey. It was a Canadian game. So Russia could not compete. The only thing they had similar to Canada was the cold weather. But they didn't have the history, didn't have the training facility and stuff. So the country, they asked this guy, his name is Tarasov, and to develop this program. Tarasov is a really interesting guy. He had no hockey background. He was a watchmaker, but he's very inventive. So what he did was he started borrowing techniques from chess and also ballet. And then watchmaking, he started incorporating all these different ideas onto ice. So he built a whole new hockey style. So if you watch the Russian players at the time, they don't skate up and down. They skate diagonally, and they don't use speed to beat you. They skate rather slowly, but they pass. You know, it's kind of like this. You know, like modern soccer style where they use the passing the ball to beat you instead of just running straight. And this became, so he built this program. But more importantly, he taught his players to love the game. All he talked about, you know, he had this young kids coming to this, his training program. He's like, you have to smile. Everyone here has to enjoy the game. If you're not loving hockey, you don't play for me. So everyone, they train really, really hard and they love hockey. So he built this unbeatable program. It's, and you know, internationally, I think they won like, they have like a, I don't know, like a 80%, 70 to 80% gold medal rate. Which is crazy. That means that, you know, for every three Olympics, they won two of them, and more than that, in fact. And, but also they medaled in every single one of them, you know, including the one they lost to the Americans, which is the 1980 in Lake Placid. So he built this program based on love and enjoyment. And then, of course, he couldn't get along with the Russian, government. He got fired and they hire another guy to replace him. This new guy, his name is Tikhonov, and there's a joke that when he's training and the American announcer will say that the Russian coach, his name is Tikhonov, he's always ticked off. And because he's this guy, if you can think about this idea of the evil Russian communist coach, then take it up another couple notches. That's the guy. And he was brutal. He was brutal to his players. And he completely turned around the philosophy from this love and you know, this inventive, this artistic way of playing hockey. And then he instilled this brutal regime where he locked up his players. They cannot leave. In fact, one player, his father got sick and he wanted to see him the last time. He wouldn't let him go. So the player never saw his father. It was a brutal training. But he succeeded the program. But the thing is, he also won. So mm-hmm. A lot of times when we imagine these Russian teams were actually thinking about this Tikhonov regime, right? This very rigid, very kind of even cruel kind of this stereotype of how Russian players play. But the program was actually originally built by Tarasov, this guy who is like an artistic, inventive guy, creative guy. So what I want to say is there are two philosophies in success, in long-term success. You can do this thing called hard discipline, which is you do the thing you hate, right? You just, how much pain can you tolerate? If you tolerate enough pain, you succeed. But also there's another way, which is called easy discipline. You know, that means you use your love of the game, right? Your enjoyment to have artistry, to have, you know, to have love. And that's how you go that far. You can both succeed, but to have long-term success in terms of not having burnout and also being inventive, I advocate for easy discipline. That's how you have success in the long term.
Yeah, sure. Because, I mean, there are so many examples of this, of hard discipline leaders getting short-term results, and they never, ever last. And these are people who sell best-selling books that everyone's like, well, if you did it like Jack Welch, you know, and it's like, well, it doesn't look so great 20 years after that, right?
No.
And so we know this at Second City because the way, you know, the it is grueling to create an entirely original comedy show, six actors who are also the writers in front of an audience over 12 weeks. It is really, really hard. It's not, you know, my friend Jeff Richmond, who's married to Tina Fey, who was a longtime director at Second City. I remember midway through one of his processes, he left me a note on my desk. This is the most inefficient way to create art ever. So it's hard, but it's hard, but it is also easy discipline, because the reason that the people do it and they suffer while they're doing it is because they love it so much. And the results are, you know, Second City turned 67 in December, you know, of this year. And we're just this legendary comedy theater. And so I want you to talk a little bit about the fact that this misconception, because the world glorifies hard discipline. I mean, that is absolutely it. But then because they think easy discipline doesn't mean hard work. And it absolutely does, right?
Yeah. A lot of leaders, when I talk to them about this, they're like, no, don't tell my workers to do easy. You know, and then I want them to push hard, because we equate hard result with hard feelings. Somehow, if you don't have to achieve, you have to feel hard. You have to feel like, you know, being up laboring all the time. But that's just not true. You know, so over, if you look at the people who changed the world, they changed history, right? They're at the top of the industry. You ask them, are you working hard? I mean, yes, they are working hard, but they also tell you, hey, I don't feel I'm working because I love this so much. I'm so passionate about this. In fact, it's hard to tell them to stop than tell them to keep going. And because they love it so much. So, And also, there's this culture where if someone who is a high achiever, right? If that person tells you, man, I do this because I can tolerate more pain than you, you're like, you're a hero. You know, that's awesome because you're doing what I can do. But if that person is like, I'm achieving this because I can't stop working. I just love this so much. Then you're like, you're a workaholic. You should see someone. You know, call someone, see someone. That's not natural. So we think you have to go against your human nature to push hard. That's somehow glorified. If you see in the last decade, right, you see a lot of people, whether they're monks or Navy SEALs, they push you this idea that you go to war against yourself. You know, just declare war on yourself. Keep pushing, keep destroying yourself. Then you can reach some height. I just feel that's so counterproductive because that's, you can't sustain this. Over the long term, you start hating yourself because you can't achieve the goals you set to yourself by constantly going against gravity, by constantly going against your human nature. So instead of going against human nature, why not go with it? Why not use your nature to push you forward?
One of the stories, a profile that you do is of Florence Nightingale. And I want you to talk a little bit about why you chose her and how she fits into this idea around easy discipline.
So Florence Nightingale, so she was, of course, she was this Victorian England, like she's a rich girl, right? She just grew up in a noble family and she would be growing up in a dream life. Right. And all everyone will be wanting to dream to have that life. But that life sucks for her because what that life entails was every day you go to this rich part. This party is put up by these rich people with you have only one job. You mingle so you can find a husband. And then when you find a husband, you have kids. Then you become a hostess of these parties. So you would know more people. So someday your kids can meet someone and also rich. So you perpetuate this family wealth. That job sucks for her. Mm-hmm. For some people, that's a dream. For her, that sucks. So for her, that's hard discipline. She's like, I'm not doing this. I'm going to do something I love. So what did she do? She loves helping people. She loved to serve the poor. In fact, she became a nurse. She became the first modern nurse. She invented this nurse profession. She went to different countries. She went to France and went to Germany to learn nursing and start reading these old reports. And she came back, you know, she brought all these, experiences back to England. So England at the time, they started the war. It's called the Crimean War against Russia. And they learned that they're treating their dying or their injured soldiers badly. Basically, you know, you get shot in that war, you just, you know, you basically put in a hospital in your blood soaked uniforms. You lie on the ground and there's very little treatment for that. And so, I mean, doctors will come in to treat you, but there's no one take care of you. So England was like, well, you know. We have this nurse person. Maybe we should send you. So they sent Florence Nightingale and a team of nurses. And then she went in, you know, so I call this a game changer. First of all, she changed her game of her life. Then usually her game, a nurse at the time is you go in, you know, you're a woman, you're this kind of servant, right? This, the military officer will tell you what to do. Then you do it. She's like, I'm not playing that game. So she changed her game again. She's like, my game is not to comfort the dying. My game is to save lives. So she started doing all kind of a reform. She started changing bed sheets. She started doing sanitation. She started doing, you know, treating these injured soldiers really well. And she dramatically, over 90%, she reduced their death rate. Now, usually, you know, at the time you get shot, that pretty much you get infected, you die. But she's the one who came in and started changing, you know, doing sanitation work, and she did a lot of work, and she dramatically improved their lives and saved a lot of lives. She came back to England after war, and she was a sensation. She was called the Lady Was a Lamb because she would walk around the soldiers at night, was a lamb, just taking care of them, and so she became this celebrity, right? Usually a celebrity in our days will be like, you know, hey, let's get on TV. Let's make some, you know, commercials. Let's give a TED talk. And she's like, I hate the celebrity life. So she again changed her life, changed her game to a reform, like a reformist. In fact, she became the first data scientist, modern data scientist, by using pie charts in her books, telling people, hey, if you do all these things, you can dramatically reduce death rate in your hospitals. She had a dramatic impact in how modern healthcare and nursing is formed. And she saved, like, you know, conservatively hundreds of millions of lives, probably billions of lives, because of how modern nursing is helping, you know, with the modern healthcare system. So I use the Florence Nightingale stories, saying sometimes you don't have to play a game that you hate. Right? This rich girl game, a lot of people would love to have. But if you hate that game, change the game to something you love and find a way to love the game you play. And that's how to change the world, you know, by doing that.
So there's two theatrical concepts that you're talking about here, which fit in exactly with what we do and what you're talking about. One is this idea of games. So, you know, we are built on games. The whole foundation of the Second City is built on these improv games created by a social worker back in the 20s and 30s by the name of Viola Spolin. Shout out to Viola. And they are crucial. They're crucial ways that people learn. And they're not just for kids. Like when we're constantly, there's game theory, there's gamifying situations, but in the popular vernacular, when you call, like, if we're selling our corporate work, we don't call it games because they're not going to buy that. But we are doing games.
Yes.
So I love that you are sort of pointing out that this idea of game, and also this idea of getting into character, because that is another thing culturally that everyone thinks, well, you're one self, and if you're being fake, if you're another self, it's like you are many selves at different times throughout the day, depending on who you're with. Absolutely. Do not act the same way with your grandma as you do with your child, as you do with your coworker, as you do with your boss. And the idea, the missing link in the world outside, because theater does this all the time, is people don't get to practice being different characters. They don't get to practice playing games. But what you discovered, especially with the rejection therapy stuff, is that is totally practicing both game playing and character playing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The thing is, you get in character, in fact, I'm in the hotel room, in Las Vegas right now. I'm playing the World Series of Poker. I'm a really good poker player. And, and one of my techniques is I get in character, you know, and I use, you know, in poker, you know, in sitting at the table, I don't just mindlessly go through the day, right? I try to play a different character. I can go from a very serious guy, very calculating, just don't say a word and be very serious and scary. Or I can be very chatty. And I started playing these characters to keep myself fresh, to have fun, you know. And sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm hitting resistance. This character doesn't fit me. I change to a different character. I do the same thing in sales, you know. And in sales, I can start becoming this guy who I can become I can get in character as a solution finder. You know, I teach salespeople to be like, if you don't like talking to people, sometimes you don't feel, if you feel too pushy, what if you try to find getting character as a consultant, maybe as a soulmate or maybe as someone, try to solve the potential, your client's problems, you know, in this way, you enjoy the work. So you can get in character to do the things you enjoy.
I just got a heart valve replacement. And when we were discussing my options in terms of what the valve was going to be, there was a chance I was going to get a mechanical valve. And I was talking to the resident who was talking to me about this, and I said, are there any downsides? He's like, I've only heard of one story that was like a big downside. And it was because the valve, you can hear it. Yeah. So if your heart rate speeds up, you hear it. And a guy got a valve replacement with a mechanical valve, and he came in like a month later and said, we have to reverse the surgery because he was a professional poker player.
That is so funny.
That is hilarious.
That is hilarious.
Like, yeah, because he can't control like the heart's going up. It's like it was a total tell. You tell another story in the book, and this is in the chapter on the power of constraints. Another misconception about creativity is, and improv in general, is that, well, it's all just free form. You're all just making it up. And like, yes, we're making it up. And if we had no box that we were making it up in, it would be nonsense. It wouldn't be good. It wouldn't work. One of my favorite artists of all time is the jazz pianist Keith Jarrett. His best-selling album of all time, The Cold Concert. Can you talk about that story? It's a good one.
It's a great story. So this guy, he's very famous pianist. He has this concert in Germany, right? And the person who organized the concert, she's a teenager, right? She promoted this event. She got the wrong piano. The pianos, they just sucked, and it was broken and couldn't work. It doesn't have the right tune. It was totally wrong. And Keith Jarrett, and he saw it once. He's like, I can't do this. He was walking out. He's like, this is a joke. I can't. It's like, asking a master to use this terrible instrument, right? That doesn't work. But the girl, she started crying. She's like, no, please don't leave. I have all these people here. So he took pity on her. He was like, okay, I'll play. So what he ended up doing was he started performing this piece, this album on this broken, and very defective piano. And then he had to compensate for the faulty instrument, he had to go extra hard. He had to improvise. He had to just lean in. And so, people were like listening. People were like, oh, this is really great. He hated it. He was like, I don't know what's going on, but because the actual effort he put in, the improvisation he put in, he created art, in real time. And that art became the best-selling piano, solo piano in history, in album history.
Still
in history. So that's why you see a lot of times we go into business meetings, we go into settings, we try to have this rehearsed talking point. Somehow if we have this perfect state, right, somehow in our mind. Somehow you can say the right thing. We do the right thing. We hit that perfect note. Boom, we win. What ends up happening is we become very rigid. We started just looking, talking nonstop, trying to find, trying to look for words to make the other person happy. If the other person frowns, I'm like, oh, I'm saying the wrong word. They become very rigid. But if you have this artist mindset, where you have constraint, but you have artist mindset, you lean into this and you can create art that's enduring. And a lot of times the result is better.
Yeah, so with Jarrett, he couldn't play the far ends of the keyboard. So by staying in the middle of the piano, it was much more melodic, and he had to sort of play with that. The pedals were sticky, and so he had to really push on those. So that created syncopation. So there's all these things that were sort of unexpected surprises. And this has come up so often, and I talked about it on a podcast I taped yesterday, which is, it came up with regard to one of the biggest problems with AI. And one of the biggest problems with AI is it doesn't know how to take advantage of being wrong.
Yeah.
And these things that are wrong are often the way that we get to some of the best stuff that we ever do. So, yeah. we know that at Second City, like we're all about embracing the failure, embracing the wrongs. And there's a line, and I posted this on LinkedIn and it got a lot of likes that you write in the book. You say, quote, "A good system doesn't focus on outcomes. A good system focuses on the inputs that make the outcomes happen."
Yes.
This is so crucial. Because if you become just outcome driven, and I'll give you an example from my world, a person, the owner of Second City will say, "Kelly, you need to produce a hit show." If I take that idea to our director, our cast, and say, "But the only thing I'm interested in is a hit show," I can guarantee you it's not going to be a hit show.
Yes.
However, if I create the conditions for them in which they can create a hit show, I will tell you I've got 85% to 90% certainty they're going to do that. And that's a lot of work to do that, but it is taking your eye off of this, gold medal, and instead be where you are now, create with other people now, use the mistakes, because those mistakes are going to be opportunities. We say in our work, see all obstacles as gifts. It's a gift. Take the gift and see what you can make out of it.
100%. Even going back to the rejection therapy idea, right? And my failure of not getting that funding was a gift. I could see as saying, all right, that's a failure and I should try something else. Or I could go with the traditional route. Okay, I should do it again. I should not quit. But I'm like, what if I can make some art with this? What if I have fun with rejection, right? So I lean into this. I did not have the idea I'm going to make a hit show on YouTube. I'm going to become a YouTuber. No, I had no way. I just want to have some fun. I want to be but I did put a lot of input into my, into my effort. I want to make sure I set up this constraints where I only ask rejections when I have fun. And I ask for things that I want to do. I want to ask for the things that it'd be cool if it happens, but I'm not pushing for it. And I'll ask for things that's moral, right? I don't rob anyone or steal it from anyone. And it doesn't undermine my marriage. I can't just ask a hot girl out because I was happily married. So I set up all these constraints. And then I said, I'm going to have the most fun. I'm going to focus on the input, which was, I want to, not be afraid of rejection. I want to make the ask. I want to smile. I want to make jokes. When I have those focus on the inputs, stop worrying about the outcome, whether there's making a hit show or whether getting a yes or no. I stop caring about getting a yes or no. I just want to come in and have a great time with that person. So if you have that goal, the result will take care of itself.
All right. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before you do that, I want you to talk a bit about this, which is one of the biggest disservices I think that Malcolm Gladwell has provided the world is this idea that 10,000 hours and you're gold. Like you can just do 10,000, which was never the full science. Yeah. Because the full science, and this comes from Anders Ericsson, involves this thing called deliberate practice, which also involves mentorship and other things. So talk a bit about, what that means to you with regard to the full idea of deliberate practice.
Yeah. So the idea of deliberate practice is become very popularized, right? Which is you practice, a particular skill set, relevant skill set with feedback, right? So instead of just mindlessly spending hours, right? You do that. Now in my book, I also say that's good, but you're in the environment is very static. It's in a static environment, a deliberate practice will work. But a lot of times in a very dynamic environment, like say basketball, right?
Yep.
Sometimes the basketball doesn't, if you can practice all you want, but if the opponents do a defense, that threw you out, that can actually take you out of your comfort zone. They can take away your number one option, number two option. Now we're in the NBA finals, right? Then if the defense adjusts, if you don't adjust, you're gonna lose. So how do you adjust to that? So I came up with this idea. I didn't come up with this idea, but I started observing this idea called it's called a repetition with variation. So basically, you do practice, deliver practice, you do the same thing, but you play different role. You change your environment every day. So there's this coach, Boston Celtics coach, Joe Mazzulla. He won the NBA championships a couple years ago. He's known as being very inventive, coach. But what he does is every training session, every practice session, he created a different scenario. The scenario is in one session, he's like, you guys are tackling each other. You guys are just go hard. Let's play football on a basketball court. And then in another environment, it's like this time no one can dribble. You can only pass. You can move and pass. And then in another environment, in another day, he's like, I'm going to play symphony. I'm going to play, I'm going to play Mozart. So now you're playing like this beautiful game. So he purposely created a different environment in every game. So now you're practicing. You're doing the same thing, but you have this repetition, but also you have this variation. Now you're more used to chaos. Now when the defense is throwing things at you, you're not completely taken out of your game because you're used to changing environments. So this is what I call repetitions with variation. And I use that in business, in business as well. In fact, rejection therapy in itself is a repetition with variation. I get rejected every day, and I used to think, I was debating, should I do 100 days of rejection therapy? Should I do the same thing every day just to get better? Doing deliberate practice, trying to get the best thing. Maybe I can rack up enough. In the end, at the beginning, I couldn't get a yes. At the end, I could get a yes. But I was like, that's not fun. When I do that, right, I probably lose interest pretty quickly. What if I ask for different rejection every day? And that's repetition with variation. I rack up so much experience and knowledge by doing that. And later on, I became very adaptable to different environments because I purposely changed up the environment.
And there's so many domains in which you can see that model be true. I know when I started working with a personal trainer, I have a very specific sort of workout regimen. And then I would go see her on Saturday and she'd do a completely other thing. And I'd wake up on Sunday in deep pain because I was like, oh, she's having me stretch muscles I don't normally stretch.
Yeah,
and there are many muscles. So yeah. I think you think about that for your work day. If you're just doing the same thing every day, what are you missing? And sometimes, there's another thing is like just put yourself in a place you normally wouldn't put yourself and see what happens.
Yes.
And while that might be uncomfortable, it's also a place where you might discover riches. All right. So we always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. Your life is a yes and story. So this is like, maybe a repetition for you, but can you pick one out a time when normally the situation would call for a no, but instead a yes. And then what happened?
Yeah. So I, now I'm a full-time author now. Right. So
yep.
I'm not a very, I don't talk to strangers a whole lot, and talking to you, I had a great time, right? But I don't naturally talk to strangers. I'm an introverted person, So to write my book, I go to Japan and in this, lake town, near Mount Fuji. And so during the day, I would write. At night, I would go to this little restaurant that is called Izakaya restaurant. Basically, you sit there, you sit across the bar and the chef will just cook for you behind the bar. So I talked to the chef, right? And usually I would just order something. I don't speak Japanese, so I speak English and they usually don't speak English that well, and so I'm just like, I'm going to order this thing. And this guy, this chef, he responded in perfect English. And I'll be like, oh, that's cool. He know English. I wonder why. So I started asking him. I started just engaging in this conversation. I started just like, I want to know. And then we started talking. He was cooking me food. Very quickly, 2 hours is gone. And we're just like, well, what happened? So as it turned out, he spent a lot of time, like me, he moved to the United States as a teenager. And he wanted to create this American dream, but he was taken advantage of here and he lost his job and he learned cooking. So he went back to Japan and actually built this beautiful restaurant to serve mostly foreigners. So he told me he fulfilled his American dream back home. And anyway, so this conversation was like, I just had a conversation with a stranger for over 2 hours. And so, you know, because I was like, yes, and, you know, and I heard him speak English and I'm like, I want to know why. And then we just went deep. And that night, the next day, he was like, Jia, do you want to go to a restaurant with me? I'll take you to my favorite restaurant. I mean, going to a restaurant with a chef, of course. He ordered stuff that I didn't even know existed. And I had a most amazing, I thought I have this one night stand with this Japanese culinary fairy, you know, and I just ate the most amazing thing. And then at night, then afterward, he and his wife took me up to this mountain, just overlooking the whole town. It was the most beautiful night ever. All because I said yes, to him when he responded in English that I felt was pretty well spoken. And we're still friends. Every time I go back to the town to write, I still meet him. And that's a friendship that keeps on giving.
I love it. That's a great story. The book is called Easy Discipline, An Unconventional Way to Achieve Ambitious Things. Jia Zhang, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.